recently we had a Russian offensive in Kharkiv, and they were making some sort of a buffer zone in that region, in the northern part of Ukraine, and a cordon sanitaire. I don't know in French how do you call it, but
Cordon
it's
sanitaire, that's true, that's true, that's
yeah.
true. But yeah. Yes, I think, well, in fact, this was said in September 2022 by Sergei Lavrov. As the first discussion emerged in the US as to yes or no, the US would provide ATACMS missiles to Ukraine. And at the time, the problem was that Ukraine wanted to have long-range missiles to attack in the depth of Russia. So they wanted the 300 kilometers variant, if you want. And the Americans were a little bit anxious that this equipment would escalate the war. And so they provided Ukraine with a reduced range, a very variant of the missile with just 100, 150 kilometers or so. So, but at that time, Sergei Lavrov said, during that discussion, he said, well, if you provide Ukraine with long-range missile, you will force us to create a buffer zone that extends beyond the range of those missiles. So if you send a missile of 300 kilometers range, you will force us to create a buffer zone of at least 100 or 300 kilometers. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, the long-range ATACMS was a red line for the US for a long time. And eventually, since they see no victory appearing at the horizon, the US decided to provide the long-range version so that Ukraine could hit Crimea and probably also the Kerch Bridge and so on and so forth. So the Russians, well, they are consistent with what they said. They say, okay, you provide long-range missiles. In addition to that, you had UK and France provide the Storm Shadow cruise missile and the French variant, which is the Scalp missile. So the Russians said, okay, you do that, so we extend our buffer zone. And that's, I think, that's the main idea. Where that will lead, where did this offensive will lead, I have no idea. Again, Vladimir Putin said that he has no intention for now to attack Kharkov. And in fact, as a matter of fact, the Russian forces that are deployed in this offensive are not sufficient to take Kharkov. I have to consider that if you take, I mean, we say traditionally that if you want to be successful in an attack, you need to have a ratio of force of 3 to 1. And if you attack a city, if you want to be successful, you need to have a ratio of 10 to 1, basically. So the forces that are deployed around Kharkov are far, far below this kind of ratio. So we see that the Russians, for now, I don't know for the future, but I think these figures or what we can observe confirms what Putin said, that for now the Russians do not have the capacities to surround and attack or take over a city of like Kharkov. So we can believe the Russians on that, but they will not renounce to have this buffer zone. Though we have to remember that the main objective of the Russians remains, that's still the same objective, it's to demilitarize Ukraine. That means that the idea is not simply to extend the buffer zone by so many hundred kilometers, it's also to destroy the Ukrainian force that are in this area. And is exactly what we are seeing. They could move very fast to the rear and create, occupy some empty zones that you certainly have behind the defensive lines of the Ukrainians. But it's not the name of the game. They want to destroy. They don't want to take ground or terrain or territories. They want to destroy the military capacities of Ukraine. And that's why the strategy of the West trying to expand this conflict, not simply escalate because they have not managed and they are probably not able to manage escalating the conflict, but at least to keep this conflict going on. It's in fact, it will just allow the Russians to destroy more forces. And that's exactly what we are seeing now, that the Ukrainians have less and less capacities. The new law on mobilization just started yesterday or so, or today even, to enter into force today. That means that the Ukrainians are slowly depleting their own reservoir or reserve of individuals. And at one point, they will remove people from the factories, they will remove people from the universities, and so on and so forth. By the way, from the universities, it has started already. That's also one effect of lowering the age for being recruited in the armed forces. That will remove some people from universities. And that's the future of Ukraine, which is hampered. And this is exactly, that's why the Western strategy is, and we see that the Western strategy is not to help Ukraine. It's just to make Russia fighting and fighting and fighting. The idea is probably not even weakening Russia, but to provoke some kind of fatigue in Russia and probably provoking some changes, political changes in the country because of the fatigue of the Russian people. The problem is that the Russians have in fact anticipated this question. And it's interesting to see, if you see the reports from foreigners in Russia, such as in Moscow and St. Petersburg and so on and so forth, and I know some journalists who have been there also. It's interesting to note that the average Russian doesn't even feel that there is a war in Ukraine. He knows it, but he doesn't even feel it because the normal life has not been affected by the conflict. Meaning that this Western idea that the conflict could create a fatigue within Russia is even misguided, because the average Russian doesn't really care, in fact. They support the government. They support this idea of supporting the population of Donbas. They support the idea of supporting the Russian-speaking people in Ukraine. But the conflict itself doesn't bother them, in fact. And that's also the reason why the Russian policy to avoid casualties and fatalities seems to work. I mean, I was checking. You see that, you know that the there is an opposition website that's called Media Zona. It's an opposition media, in fact, that works with Medusa, which is a very well known opposition media that operates, by the way, from the Baltic states. I think it's from Estonia or Latvia. I'm not sure. But in any case, so Mediazona works with these opposition media and works with the British BBC. And they make an estimate of the number of fatalities, of Russian fatalities on the battlefield, based on what you can find on the social networks, on the media, on the press, and so on and so forth. So we can argue about the methodology, but I think it's a most credible methodology I have seen regarding the number of the evaluation of casualties and fatalities since the government, both Ukrainian and Russian government, don't publish official figures for their own casualties. So if recently I looked at this Mediazona website, and I found that the number of Russian fatalities for the whole 2 years of conflict is roughly above 50,000 killed soldiers. While on the other side in Ukraine, although there was an attempt to do the same kind of job, but it was closed down very quickly by the government last year. And the figures that are estimated by experienced individuals range between 400,000 and 600,000 fatalities. So we're not talking about fatalities. We're talking about talking about casualties. We're talking about fatalities. That mean killed people. So roughly, Ukraine has about 10 times the number of fatalities than the Russians. So meaning that beyond the ratio of fatalities, beyond the ratio and the figures, we can understand that in Russia, the conflict is not doesn't affect the daily life of individuals. As a result, the Western strategy of trying to create this fatigue is totally wrong, because it doesn't, again, the problem of the West, they work based on their own assumptions. They take their assumptions as facts, but the reality is that the Russians are not even affected by this conflict. And even when you look at the statistics of individuals in favor of against the Russian strategy in Ukraine and all that, you see that there are still about 10% or 15% of the population that is not even interested in this conflict, meaning that there is no the impact of the conflict within Russian territory is extremely weak, and so the Russians in fact are ready to wage a very long-lasting war in reality. And that is, by the way, reflected by the new composition of the government. I don't want to go, because you had probably other commentators commenting this these changes in the government, but I just want to point out that Belousov, since he has we have the same academic background, if you want, we studied the same thing. I mean, this is econometrics, which is modeling of economics based on statistics and mathematics, which is in fact the science of forecasting economy. And we have the same education, academic education. And that's why I understand why Vladimir Putin has chosen Belousov to succeed to Shoigu. Shoigu created recreated the Russian military-industrial complex, if you want. because this military industrial complex was extremely powerful during the Cold War. Then after the Cold War, there were other priorities, and this military industrial complex was reduced. But now Shoigu resurrected that MIC. And the purpose of having Belousov in that is because Belousov used to work for the Ministry of Economy. So the idea here is to harness the capacities and the capabilities of the Russian economy to serve both the military needs and the civilian needs, and to develop the military industrial complex without affecting the industrial civilian development, if you want. So that requires a very fine tuning in combining the capabilities of both the military industrial complex and the civilian industrial complex. Because traditionally, and that was the case during the Cold War, you had a lot of factories and production plants that were working on both civilian and military for military product. So, and this tradition remains more or less less than during the Cold War, but it remains a little bit in Russia, meaning that you really need to fine tune your capabilities so that you don't have a civilian economy that become suffocated by the military economy. And that's in fact what was reflected in the various interviews and meeting where Vladimir Putin expressed the reason why he wanted to have this change. And that reflects also idea of, let's say, the perception of the Russians that they are in a war of attrition. Russia wages an aggressive attrition war against Ukraine, but at the same time, because the West is providing continuous support to Ukraine, both in terms of finance, equipment, and even support to the Ukrainian economy, that means that the Russians are ready to wage a very long war, and they understand that the West wants to wage an attrition war against Russia. And that's the reason why for Russia it's a key aspect to prepare for the future in the long run, not just to have a surge in the military industrial complex to solve the problems of until the end of this year, for instance, in Ukraine, but also to be able to provide a long-term capability and capacity to Russia. And that's the reason of the nomination of Belousov to this position. So he will continue the work of Shoigu, but in a more integrated understanding of the problem. So that in fact reflects something that I have also explained in my book, The Russian Art of War. This is this holistic understanding of war by the Russians. They understand that war is not just what happens on a battlefield. War is a whole aspect. It affects the society. It affects the whole different dimension of a state and a nation. As a result, they have to prepare for that. And one aspect of this for the Russians, for this particular conflict, is to make sure that the conflict that is going on in Ukraine doesn't affect the morale and the activities in the mainland Russia, if you want. And so that's part of this holistic understanding, which is in the military doctrine is understood as the correlation of forces, meaning that the different components of the society and a component of the state must in fact work together towards a single objective. And for that, you need to tailor your approach of the various aspects of the society in order to have your focus on what you want to achieve. And if you go deep into this approach, we'll see that the Russians have a very deep strategic approach of this conflict, as opposed to the West, with just reacting in a day-to-day basis to what's going on in the field. And you see that in the sense that not only the Western assumptions that were made at the very beginning of the conflict were totally wrong, and that everything that was supplied and everything, yes, that was supplied to Ukraine was in fact based on wrong assumptions. And now they have to adjust on a day-to-day basis to the realities on the ground. That's exactly the reason why the West has in fact gone over their own red line, the red line they defined for themselves. They have to pass all these red lines themselves, because these red lines were based on wrong assumptions. And that indicates a tactical approach to the conflict rather than the Russian one, which is a strategic approach to the war. As I explain in my book, the difference, if I can summarize a little bit, the West tends to see the war as a picture, while the Russians tend to see the war as a movie. And that explains exactly the difference, the different mindset in which the Russian address this conflict. And that's the reason why they are more successful, because they don't stick to one picture, but they try to understand the whole movie. And that gives them a depth in the future. And that's exactly what, that will be the task of Belousov in addressing the development of the military and the military-industrial complex in harmony with the rest of the country, the development of the rest of the country. This is a perfect illustration of the concept of correlation of forces. And I think that's a key point of the way the Russians understand war. And that's also the key point that the West is missing. And that's the reason why in all the conflicts we have collaborated or contributed to in Afghanistan, Iraq, and so on and so forth, we tend to stick to the tactical vision of the war, not a strategic vision. In any of this battlefield or theaters, I could say, the West had a consistent objective and a consistent strategy to address the problem. That's the reason why they failed. That's the reason of the main reason for the failure of the West in addressing war is the absence of strategic vision. We understand the war as an addition of tactical action, and Russian tends to see that as the strategic vision that can then be decomposed in a series of operational objectives and then tactical objectives. So it's a totally different, diametrical, different opposition, different view. And that's the reason of the success of the Russians. Yeah. And probably the Chinese are in the same way.
Just before wrapping up this session, one more question would be the current situation in Georgia. We had a new law on foreign agents passed by the parliament, then vetoed by the president. And it's so amazing because I have never seen a foreign-born citizen being a president of a country. Here in Brazil, if you want to be the president of Brazil, you have to be born in Brazil. In the United States, the same. I have never seen such a thing. Recently, I've learned that the president of Georgia was not born in Georgia. She was born in France. It's so
well, and you had Mr. Saakashvili, who became a politician in Ukraine, by the way, and he had never been in Ukraine before. So, but the problem is that we have to understand that these countries used to be part of the Soviet Union or in communist countries, and when the communism collapsed in the early 90s, you had no elites that were able to take over the political life. And the thing is that all these countries, both, I mean, all the republics of the Soviet Union, including Russia, by the way, were contemplating the Western model. The problem is that they had no elites that were able to understand that model. They had no elite able to manage the country. All these elites had been trained under the communist rule. They were trained in the communist academies and military academies and so on and so forth. And you had no non-communist elites, so to say. So that was a challenge, because where do you get the right people to develop the country in this direction you want to go to? So that's a very peculiar situation, and that's the reason why you had several individuals who had been raised in the West, who then came back in their country of origin and started to make a political life there. You had a lot of politicians. For instance, especially in the Baltic state and Poland and so on, a lot of politicians were trained in Switzerland, for instance. We trained them and then sent them some young ministers that I knew, because when I made a post-grade education in the Graduate Institute for International Studies in Geneva, I made those specific training for international relations, international security, and all that. But a couple of those, the guys I was studying to, are today ministers in Baltic states. So this is that was the problem in the early 90s. How do you get those elites? And that explains the reason why you have this situation. But it's a peculiar situation, because you have people, and that was very obvious with Saakashvili, because Saakashvili used to be the prime minister or president of Georgia, and then it was expelled. And by the way, now he's in prison in Georgia because of embezzlement, or I don't know, corruption. I don't know exactly the reason. But in any case, this guy left Georgia, his country, because he was offered a position in Ukraine. And in Ukraine, they offered a minister position. And you had even Americans that had, in fact, just a Ukrainian origin, and they came back and they received the Ukrainian citizenship, and so they had a political position in Ukraine, because there were no such elite in the country. So the problem there is to assess because the reason why we take Brazilian to lead Brazil and Swiss to lead Switzerland and so on and so forth is that at the end of the day, you need to work in the interest of your country. So you need to have to be bound to this country. You need to have your roots in this country. I mean, physical roots, not just intellectual roots. And that's probably the problem and the reason why you have the Baltic states. And I explained before that when I was in NATO, I noticed how these Eastern European officers had, in fact, much more, they had more relationship with United States than with their own country, because a lot of them were in fact immigrated in the US. During the whole Cold War. I mean, I remember when I was in Washington, D.C. In the late, I mean, the 80s, late 80s. So that was during the Cold War. The Soviet Union was still existing. When you had in the whole, the big whole of the State Department in Washington, D.C., you had all the flags, all the nations, they are in the ceiling of this entrance hall. And you had that was surprising. You had even the flags, and again, that was during the Cold War. They had the flags of Estonia, of Latvia and Lithuania, for instance, because for the US never recognized the authority and the sovereignty of the Soviet Union in these countries. As a result, you had these countries had authorities in the US. They had a small administration funded by the US government. And in these guys were in fact the nucleus of those who came back in the early 90s to create the fundamental of the this politician. So you had very strong ties with the US. As a result, these guys are still, and that's normal. They are grateful for the US, and they have probably more relationship with the US than with their own country, if you want, to some extent. So we can understand that. The problem is that at the end of the day, you have a kind of a conflict of interest. And that's exactly what you see when you go in these countries today, because the rational interest assessment, I mean, if you would assess that rationally, you would say it would be beneficial for these countries to have to say, okay, Cold War was the Cold War, and today we are in a new era. We shake hands, we make peace, and we start working together. But it's not what happened. They are still, they are probably, the situation is worse than the Cold War. This antagonistic type of relationship between the local population, I mean, the Estonian population and the Russians is extremely strong. And when I say the Russians, I'm not just mentioning the Russians from Russia, also mentioning the Russians from Estonia. Because they hate these guys so much that they didn't even provide, I mean, they provide so tough condition for them to have the Estonian or Latvian citizenship. It's almost impossible because they need to speak fluently the language and so on and so forth. As a result, the European Union, by the way, had to create a special passports for these guys, so they have a European citizenship, because in their own country they are non-citizens. There's a concept of non-citizen, which shows the level of hatred that remains, and that it also shows the lack of willingness for the new authorities of these countries trying to integrate all this population into one nation. They created two nations within the same boundaries, if you want, and the same borders. So you have the Estonian population and the non-Estonian, so to say. And this is extremely strange. I mean, I'm Swiss, as you know. I come from a country where you have four different languages, four different national languages, and three official languages. And we have so different nationalities, and so on. We speak Italian, German, Romansh, French, and German, of course. So for us, it's natural to have different nationalities, different culture into the same borders and working together towards the same objective. But it's definitely not the way the Baltic states saw the problem. And even in Ukraine, because I remember, and by the way, this is one of the key elements to understand the conflict in Ukraine, that the Ukrainians, especially when the new extreme nationalistic, ultra-nationalistic, even we can say neo-Nazi for some aspects of this new government that emerged in 2014, these guys had a so ultra-nationalistic approach that they considered the Russians as subhuman. And you had very interesting interviews, by the way, from people who were demonstrating in Maidan in 2014, explaining that they wanted a pure Ukraine, a Ukraine pure. And that was explained, by the way, in several texts that I mentioned in my book, in my books. That explained that they wanted an ethnically pure Ukraine. And that was reflected in the law on indigenous people that was adopted on the 1st of July 2021, that explained that different people in Ukraine coming from different origins have different rights. So it's not that the rights are given to anybody, the same rights to everybody. No, the rights you have depend on your ethnicity. And I have mentioned probably, I don't have it right away, but I can show that in the next, if you agree to have another discussion on that. But a Ukrainian politician of the party, the servant of the people, the party of Volodymyr Zelensky, by the way. And this guy said on the 2nd of July, just after adopting this law, this lawmaker said, from now on, the Russians will not have the same rights as the Ukrainians. They will not benefit from all the constitutional rights of the Ukrainians, and they will not benefit from the human rights as the other Ukrainians. So that explains that the split within the Ukrainian society, which was in fact divided by ethnical criteria after 2014. And that explains how this conflict developed from that point and in fact led to the situation we have today. And that explains also why you have a so wide support from the Russian population for the conflict in Ukraine, because the Russians know that, because what I said about this law, for instance, on indigenous people, this was not really reflected. I mean, no media mentioned that in 2021 in France, Belgium, or Switzerland, because of course nobody wants to advertise this kind of thing. But the Russians, they understand, they know that, because they know they have parents, they have family in Ukraine and vice versa. So that means that this information circulated. And by the way, that's the reason why Vladimir Putin wrote this article on the 12th of July 2021 about the unicity of the Ukrainian and the Russian people, and saying, he said in substance, that there is no reason to make a difference between Ukrainians and Russia because they have the same roots. And that was interpreted in the West and in Western media as Vladimir Putin doesn't want to recognize the sovereignty of Ukraine. But in fact, it was not the purpose. This article was explicitly a response to this law on indigenous people that was adopted on the 1st of July. And the purpose of that was to explain to the Ukrainians that there is no point making a difference, an ethnical difference between Russians and Ukrainians, and there's no point to have a war between these peoples. So this is something that, of course, the Western media has not reflected in any way, and explains why we don't understand this conflict. We don't understand it as the Russians understand it. And that's the reason why, for the Russians, the Russian population, there is an existential dimension of the conflict. It's probably not the existential dimension in the geopolitical sense. It's existential in the societal sense, to some extent, especially for the population of the Ukraine. I mean, the south and west, east of Ukraine. So, and if you fail to understand that, there is no way you can understand the whereabouts of this conflict. That's why it's very important to understand this this ethnical aspect that has been consistently put aside by the Western media, because of course they don't want to acknowledge that they're supporting a racist state, which is in fact the case.